Hey everybody, welcome to the briefing room on this gorgeous Monday. Happy Earth Day. I'm Devin Dwyer in Washington with Deputy Political Director Mary Alice Parks.
Ugh, if you're not outside, we feel sorry for you, because here in D.C. it is just a gorgeous Monday.
It's amazing. And check out our new friends Wilma and Zora behind us. Chris Plater has got a nice picture of the behind there of, we think that's Wilma.
And we can, are you sure?
We can smell her as well on this Earth Day. But excited to have you with us today on this 49th anniversary. We know that celebrations are going on all across the globe to mark this Environmental Awareness Day, Mary Alice. And you know, so many people are out here carrying signs. It does seem sort of uplifting to see so many people caring about the environment.
Yeah, especially because the environment has become a total lightning rod in our politics. We are seeing the Democratic candidates out there on the campaign trail making it a centerpiece of their politicking. It is more divisive than ever. Environmental protection and climate change continues to be a huge partisan issue.
A top issue on the campaign trail as we look towards 2020. We'll have much more coming up on the politics of climate and the environment. But first, some big headlines this morning out of the White House, and for those, I want to bring in our White House reporter, Jordan Phelps. She's on the North Lawn now. Jordan, great to see you. Happy Easter. You were out there at the Easter egg roll on the South Lawn this morning, and the president clearly has impeachment still on his mind.
Yeah, Devin, the president was asked there by a reporter if he was at all concerned about the prospect that he could be removed from office, and the president said, not even a little bit. But, Devin, we know that's simply not true, because the president has been tweeting furiously about this topic. He sent off a tweet about it just about an hour before he went out to the Easter egg roll. He was tweeting about it all weekend. So this is definitely something that's playing on his mind. He's definitely not helping make this storyline go away any more than those Democrats who are saying that perhaps the president should be impeached. It's worth noting, Devin, that this is a storyline that in some ways politically is actually advantageous to President Trump. It's something that he can use to cast Democrats as being unreasonable and over-political, and also he can use it to rile up his own base. And it seems like, you know, the president is not shying away from talking about this at all and is very much welcoming this fight.
Yeah, and Jordan, as the Democrats decide what they're going to do next in the wake of the Mueller report, the president is also talking a little bit about that less redacted version of the report that we know some members of Congress today got to look at for the first time, right, with some of that blacked out material lifted up. Who got to see it, and what are they saying?
Yeah, the top Republican on the House Judiciary went over to the Justice Department today, spent about 2 hours behind closed doors looking at this less redacted version of the report that Attorney General Barr has made available. Devin, this report in a less redacted version has been made available to about a dozen members of Congress. It's worth noting that you're not going to see any Democrats going over to the Justice Department to check this out. They have said this is unacceptable for them to only see a less redacted version. They continue to demand that they see the full report. They have subpoenaed to see that full report. So the Democrats are not giving up on that battle to see the full thing here, Devin.
All right, much more of that battle ahead this week and next when Congress is back, for sure. Jordan Phelps, thanks so much for that at the White House. The president, Mary Alice, also talking about Earth Day. He acknowledged Earth Day on Twitter this morning. The White House put out an official statement. Let's put that up. The president said that environmental protection is very important to him. It does go hand in hand, he said, with economic prosperity. He said that a strong market economy is essential to protecting our ultimately our natural resources and fostering a legacy of conservation. Interesting there, Mary Alice, because the president talks about loving the environment, but also talks about loving the economy first, which is a buzzword to a lot of liberals and environmental activists, that the president doesn't actually mean what he says in some of this stuff.
Right, and make no mistake, this administration has had a huge pivot in terms of environmental protection and any effort to get the country closer to renewable energy and fewer emissions. And that's been a big issue for environmental activists. You know, I can think of three big areas right off the top of my head. There's all the Endangered Species Act protections that are afforded to a lot of species, like the American bison that used to be an endangered species.
Right, it's a benefit of the Endangered Species Act.
It is. We've seen the population rebound. The Trump administration has worked to slowly kind of step back some of those protections for under the Endangered Species Act. Another big bucket, we're talking a lot about offshore drilling. The Trump administration has really been a proponent of expanding the parts of federal waters in the Arctic and the Atlantic where they could do more leasing for increased drilling. That's created quite a lot of friction between states on the Atlantic and Pacific seaboard that are just not interested in that, including
very
a lot of red states and purple swing states like Florida comes to mind. Florida has repeatedly told the Trump administration kind of to back off. And then, you know, the last big bucket I would say is just actual land monuments. We've seen a number of national parks and natural monuments that the Obama administration greenlit that we've watched the Trump administration start to roll back protections for, literally shrinking some of the maps around those national monuments. So you have environmental protectionists and activists saying that this administration is really going in the opposite direction, especially compared to the Obama administration that was really pushing the envelope in the other way.
And a lot of those environmental activists using this day, this annual Earth Day, to shine a spotlight on our politics
right.
and on this president for his policies when it comes to the environment and the earth. We caught up with one of those activists just a short time ago. Dennis Hayes is a co-founder of Earth Day back in 1970. He was here today to talk about what that day means now and what he has planned for its 50th anniversary next year. Take a listen. Dennis, great to meet you. Thanks for talking with us. So, 49 years of Earth Day. What's the impact been when you look back at the legacy of this day?
Well, the impacts are multiple. I mean, certainly the creation of the EPA, the passage of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Forest Protection Act, Superfund, National Toxic. I mean, the legislative impact has been spectacular. Tens of trillions of dollars have been spent in
but healthier and more sustainable. But you associate that with greater awareness caused by days like this.
Yes, and in fact, they all. It took pieces of legislation that were unthinkable in 1969 and made them literally unstoppable in 1970. The Clean Air Act, which was opposed by the oil industry, the coal industry, the automobile industry, the electric utility industry, the steel industry, passed the Senate unanimously and the House of Representatives with one dissenting vote. I mean, the
very
people, when they get
now.
Mobilized, yes.
I mean, a very different time, and people are mobilized now. There is this greater awareness. It's been 49 years in the making, and yet, you hear from environmental activists like yourself that the situation is really dire right now. How do you reconcile those two things? People are more aware, they're conserving more, and yet it's gotten pretty bad.
Yeah, well, what we had in 1970 were things that were visible and they were immediately impacting people. So the air in Pittsburgh, in Gary, Indiana, in Los Angeles then was like the air in Shenzhen or New Delhi or Mexico City today. And people, their kids couldn't go out for recess because the air was so bad. It's the Cuyahoga River was catching on fire. The bald eagle was endangered. When you've got that sort of imminent thing that is visible, it's easier to get people engaged. The problems now are global, and whereas we all think that America should be a leader out there, leading the world into solving the climate crisis, there is a body of opinion that says, why should we do it until everybody else jumps in the pond with us at the same time? To which the answer is, if we jump in first, we can develop and sell all of the technologies that are part of that revolution. But that's not the way our president sees it.
Well, and you know how slow the legislative process is, can be in this country, and just getting us to jump in seems to be a Herculean effort. You got the rest of the world as well. I mean, you've said some pretty stark warnings about the state of affairs right now. Are we past the point of being able to fix it and stop it and slow it?
You know, we are past the point of not having more frequent and more powerful hurricanes. We're past the point of last month having two record-setting floods in Iowa that destroyed the livelihood of farmers who've been there for generations. Past the point of not having forest fires ripping up and down the West Coast. But we're not at the point where we're facing toward human extinction and the other great, massive things that are happening. But that window is closing. And so what we're doing in the year 2020 is not just in the United States, but around the world. We'll have events in more than 180 countries.
It's the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
It will be. And the 30th anniversary of it being an international thing. We're in 180 countries now. And I think we'll be getting a few billion people will be out making
billions.
A demand. Yes, billions.
Wow.
We had more than a billion last year. And I expect we're probably going to turn out with more than a billion this year. But to directly address your question, having that affect national things is much harder now than it was then. So where we have been so far most effective is at states, at cities. There are a great many states and cities.
California's
been spectacular. Yeah. It's got a timetable and steps between here and 100% renewables by 2045. And you've got similar things going on in lots and lots of places. What we need to do now is marry that with what we're calling Vote Earth. And a big part of this is to take the environment and climate in particular up and make it a voting issue, one of those emotional things.
A new poll out today says millennial voters, 18 to 29-year-olds, have climate change atop their list as we head in. 2020 also, obviously, the presidential election as well. And you've talked about the real Earth Day being Election Day.
The actual April 22nd, of course, is right smack in the middle of primary season,
right.
So that will help elevate the issue as people are going into it. You know, in the past, we've had a rough time getting, we've not succeeded in getting a single question about climate introduced into the presidential debates. In 2020, we want to have an entire debate that is devoted to more detail, not some fluffy, yes, I care about the climate and I want to make the world a better, but a place where candidates actually have to discuss what it is that they plan to do. And I think we're going to pull that off in the United States, and there are 60 other countries having elections over the course of the next 2 years.
2020 is going to be a really big year. 50th anniversary for Earth Day, a presidential election. As well. Dennis Hayes, thanks so much. Great to meet you.
Devin, it was a pleasure.
Thank you. And our thanks to Dennis Hayes. And indeed, 49 years after the first Earth Day, it does seem the focus on climate is much more significant now in our politics. He suggested perhaps there'll be a climate-focused Democratic primary debate. Is that something that you see as being possible?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of buzz about that as a possibility, and I think that's for a few reasons. We're seeing Democrats on Capitol Hill really push this issue. Just today in the Senate, there was the announcement there was a new environmental justice caucus formed in the House. Speaker Pelosi has that new select committee on the climate crisis. And Democrats would argue that we're at a crisis point in this conversation. You know, the UN put out a report at the end of last year that said that the world and the global community only has a decade left to get carbon emissions under control to avoid catastrophic consequences. So Democrats are saying that now or never, we got to do something.
And driving the conversation, driving a lot of the energy in the Democratic Party, at least, it is the younger segment of that party. Younger people are really wanting and calling on their political leaders to make climate change a top priority. A new poll out today affirms that finding. This one from Harvard University, the Institute of Politics. Take a look at the top line. Very interesting. Struck us. Millennials, 18 to 29, said that protecting the environment should be a top goal of U.S. Foreign policy. That's 34%, highest in a generation. They also found that 46% of Americans think that the government should do more to curb climate change, even at the expense of economic growth, which, of course, the president talked about today. Look at that jump from just 4 years ago, up 10 points, more than 10 points, 14 points. In calling on the government to do more, that is young people driving this conversation.
And we've seen some of those youngest members up on Capitol Hill, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, introducing sweeping legislation to push this agenda forward. I mean, her legislation would create totally zero emissions, net zero emissions in the United States by 2050. A lot of other Democrats recognize that is pretty aspirational. That'd be hard to achieve in a short time frame. But she's up there saying, look, we gotta have big goals. And obviously, she's the youngest member on Capitol Hill, to your point, that I think young people are largely driving this conversation.
Yeah, and a lot of young people also suing the federal government right now. We're going to talk to one of them as well, trying to keep up the pressure in the courts. But first, our producer, Amari, went out on the streets, talk to some tourists on this Easter Monday in New York City, young people, about what they think of climate change and what they're doing to stay green. Take a listen.
How do you feel about climate change?
Very terrified about it.
Yeah, strongly.
And I feel worried about it. I guess it's what I would choose to say.
Yeah. Well, for the future generation, I mean, we need to reduce our CO2 levels and make sure that we're recycling.
Are you guys going green? Do you guys recycle?
Yeah, yes.
Well,
as much as we can.
We recycle as much as we can. It's frustrating because most of the United States doesn't recycle anymore.
We don't actually own cars, so we use a lot of public transport. Trying to help the environment that way as well.
And then just being aware of how we're using resources, even water usage, making sure we're keeping that within what's acceptable.
And going paperless anywhere possible as well.
We try to do our part to reduce our carbon footprint, that being
trying to not throw out as much stuff, using less plastic.
You think to go green? Do you recycle?
Look at me, man. I got my bags right here.
I've got about a trove of those bags myself. I'm sort of a crazy recycler. I'm like all about saving everything.
Well, we've been trying in our household to limit plastic use, and it's amazing once you start keeping track of just how much plastic.
It's everywhere. I
mean, not even just the bottles, but the lids on every Starbucks cup, every plastic straw. I do think that we will see millennials continue to push in the consumer space and push companies to be a little bit more environmentally conscious, and that'll make a big difference.
Got to get used to those paper straws. I don't know if I'm there yet.
Just no straws.
Let's bring into this conversation now a couple of young environmental activists who have a unique perspective on this debate and this conversation. Issa Flores-Jones is a senior at Harvard University, joins us now. She's one of the undergrads but participates in the Environmental Justice Group. Also is trying to get Harvard and a number of universities to divest from fossil fuels. Issa, great to see you. What are your thoughts on this Earth Day, and how's it coming with your effort to get Harvard to cut off the fossil fuel use?
Hi there. Thanks so much for allowing me to contribute to this conversation, because I feel as if, from my vantage point, one of the biggest things is this. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you.
Awesome. Is this feeling of sort of helplessness and apathy that we're really trying to fight as individuals, and to use our power as students in a campaign to be able to ask one of the world's largest endowments to divest from fossil fuels. And so the campaign that I'm a part of is asking for Harvard University, which has an endowment of $39 billion, which is larger than that of Coca-Cola and almost as big as that of Facebook. And it's asking for that endowment to relinquish its holdings on oil, fossil fuel, and natural gas. And I think...
And what has the response been, Issa? What has the university generally been saying? Is there any openness on their part to considering your arguments?
I think the response from the university is pretty much to direct our efforts towards those smaller scale measures that you guys were mentioning a little bit earlier, to talk about replacing the trays in the dining hall, for example, or perhaps turning off the lights. Recently, I'm one of the activists who's attended meetings with the president of the university, to which he will often direct us to the university's energy consumption and say, well, why don't you try to change that? But I think what is a part of our theory of change and our idea about what we can all be doing collectively to make this transition happen is to ask that these institutions change their models of investing as well, and that it's not all on the individual. Because, to be quite honest, I don't have a lot of money. I'm a student. It means that my voice is not really heard. I'm young. It means that I'm not really admitted access to the same sorts of halls of power. And I think that all of us right now, especially here on this campaign at Harvard, feel as if we are seizing this ability to call on this institution to be able to make that change. But to answer your question, they haven't really been listening.
And what's the line for you? Is it just drilling? Do you put pipelines in that category? How are you sort of explaining to Harvard what your standard would be?
Yeah, so right now, Harvard, the majority of their money is actually not invested directly into those measures that you're talking about, into pipelines, into sort of coal mining operations. One of the things that they are doing where they are directly invested is actually in large land grabs, where they're participating in the theft of international land. They essentially buy land from third-party buyers who seize it from indigenous and collectively managed operators. And often they put in soybean and other kinds of large agribusiness into that area, and essentially are displacing people. That's where their direct investments are. So part of the campaign is pushing for them to cease that practice, but the majority of the campaign is focused on these indirect investments. So it's asking Harvard to essentially change their model of investing and to pull their money out of these commingled funds. And all of this is like extremely opaque. And so what we're really asking is for more transparency from this university, transparency to the students who are here on their campus, transparency to the communities around the college, transparency to everybody who thinks about higher education as a model for leadership. And we're asking for them to essentially divest from what we call the fossil fuel industrial complex, really, which is every part of the system.
Issa, stand by. Speaking of transparency, I want to bring in Vic Barrett, a student at University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is part of that group of students who's suing the federal government in court for not being transparent enough about the threats and dangers of climate change, also not doing enough. Vic, great to see you. You're also particularly worried about rising seas, and that's been a focus of your advocacy there. Tell us about what you're doing on that front.
Yeah, so I've been a part of the lawsuit since I was 16 years old and in high school. And a lot of what drove me to be a part of the lawsuit was doing climate activism in New York City and seeing how climate activism is related to environmental racism and how climate change has a lot of systematic and institutional ways that it manifests in other people's lives disproportionately. And I started thinking about my own identity as being Central American, being Garifuna, which is an Afro-Indigenous community, to Honduras, and us being coastal people who exist on the coast, and seeing that my culture, things that really mean a lot to me, could be completely decimated, cannot exist in history books due to things like sea level rise that is totally being perpetuated by a lot of systems that our country has put into place.
There's actually been sort of a moment of Native people, Indigenous people across the world banding together over environmental protection. And we've seen that from rural Alaska to tribes in the rainforest. Can you talk a little bit about that community that's formed globally?
Yeah, it's definitely been a huge coming together of Indigenous people from all over the world that exist in their own cultures, you know, varying thousands of miles away, but have the shared identity of being really vulnerable to these issues, but also always being stewards of the land, always being people that cared about the land, and who we should be turning to for solutions on how we move forward socially and culturally when it comes to protecting our earth and what we put into doing that.
Issa Flora Jones, back at Harvard, on this Earth Day, what's one small thing all of us can do to help protect the environment on this day? Give us one piece of advice from your toolbook.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the immediate thing that we're asking people to do on campus is to come out to our particular mass movement, which is this Friday's Flood Harvard rally at 2:30, but really it's to show up for those mass movements that are happening across the country and really across the world. We take so much inspiration both from the work of Indigenous environmental activists and also from presently Extinction Rebellion is sort of showing us how to do it, showing us how to step out and take part, and I think combating that apathy in any way that's possible.
And Vic, what about you? What are you telling your friends and neighbors who are concerned, who want to be involved?
Yeah, I think that where I always start with people is definitely from a place of education, because I think that people can do the actions that are necessary. You know, at being on a college campus, too, it's not just changing the straws and changing the trays. It's about looking at the institutional, fundamental systemic things that are perpetuating this crisis. And learning a little bit more about those things gives you more tools to actually be able to talk to your politicians about the things that they can be doing other than just red herring or very high visible but low impact things.
All right, Vic Barrett, a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. You're also one of those suing the federal government in court. We'll keep an eye on that court case. Great to have you. Thank you for sharing your perspective with us. Also want to thank Issa Flores Jones joining us from Harvard University and her efforts there for environmental justice. Thank you both. Interesting conversation. And
I feel like they sort of made fun of us. You were like, I recycle, and I talked about plastic straws, and they said we have to think a lot bigger.
Bigger.
Than that.
I mean, she said, you know, Harvard, Jay put this challenge to Harvard, and Harvard comes back and says, well, we'll change the trays in the cafeteria. And it is a good reminder from those two that this is so much bigger than that. We all have to think bigger, and certainly our politicians do as well. Interesting footnote to the conversation we were having earlier. Just learned in the past few minutes that one of the Democratic 2020 contenders, Governor Jay Jay Inslee of Washington State, who's built a campaign on his presidential campaign on this idea of active, aggressive approach to the climate, is now calling on all 27 Democratic nominees to participate in a climate change only debate. So we'll see. We were talking about, you think it's quite likely, but he's leading the way on this.
Absolutely. He has been pushing those issues in his home state, Washington State, actually where I grew up. He's been pushing the idea of a possible carbon tax, of trying to increase renewable energy there in Washington State. And the state itself, though we think of it as very green, big, beautiful mountains, it's had a lot of issues as well. I think about the orca whales that are really struggling in his state. So he is well aware and sort of in that conversation. And you're right, pushing the other Democratic candidates to join him on the debate stage.
All right, moving away from politics now, we are at the National Zoo. This is your zoo. It's run by the Smithsonian Institute here in Washington,
D.C. That is
a
cool part, right?
It is
awesome.
You can just
walk in, it's
free.
You
can come in. Great crowds here today for this Earth Day. Also, it happens to be National Park Day. Our friends Wilma and Zora are back here. They're taking a little nap. They just had lunch.
It's hot out.
It is very hot out. But we wondered today, before we got here, what zoologists are thinking about climate change and the impact that it has on animals in this country. We caught up a little while ago with Mel Songer, a zoologist here at the zoo, who told us what to look for. Take a listen.
There are several things we're already seeing when it comes to climate change. We're seeing a shift in habitat, so often a reduction in habitat for species. We're seeing changes in migration in terms of locations and also arrival. And so we're expecting that to continue, potentially leading to kind of a desynchronization of the interactions of species, so compounding effects. I think that especially we're worried about pandas that specialize. So they specialize in habitat or a particular type of food. And the giant pandas are a good example of that. They are, of course, using bamboo. They're using bamboo forests. And they're existing on these mountain islands. And what we expect with climate change is that these islands are going to get steadily smaller and we have less space for the pandas. Currently, what's being hardest hit is really the Arctic regions where we have a loss of sea ice. And this is impacting what we've seen most is the polar bears, because they, of course, need the sea ice in order to get their prey, in order to connect their habitats. And so we're already seeing some dramatic changes in their habitat. There's a lot we're doing in terms of trying to understand what habitat they need, understanding how much space they need, how they're moving in those different habitats. And that we can use that to model how they're potentially going to be impacted when their habitats are changed by climate change. And that we can use to try to mitigate some of those impacts.
All right, our thanks again to Mel Songer, a zoologist here at the National Zoo. And a reminder, it's not just humans that are suffering from the impact of climate change, but a lot of animals as well.
I mean, I was struck to learn that one of our 50 states, Hawaii, is the epicenter of a lot of extinctions. They have a number of rare birds and rare fish species. And the idea that in 2019, with all of our technology, our advanced technology, we would still let species go extinct, it just breaks my heart. And right here in our own country.
Important reminder there. Here at the National Zoo, it's not just about animals on this Earth Day, but it's about families on this Easter Monday, a big tradition in the D.C. community that goes back decades. Erica King joins us now, one of our producers who spent the morning talking with African-American families here at the zoo on Earth Day. Erica, great to see you. You were telling us that this is a big deal in the community here at the
right.
zoo on Earth Day. Tell us why.
Happy Easter Monday, guys.
Yeah.
So I find this so fascinating because this tradition began back in 1878. According to the Smithsonian National Museum of African American Culture and History, they began this tradition because African American families worked a lot on Easter Sunday. So they allowed them to celebrate Easter Sunday on Monday. And also during the segregation era, African American families were not allowed to celebrate the annual White House Easter egg roll. So again, the zoo opened its doors.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
and this is the day that they came to celebrate. You caught up with some of the people that were here celebrating today. Let's meet some of those folks.
We heard Washington Zoo is the best place to be for Easter Monday.
Is this kind of been like a tradition for your group to come here every year for Easter Monday?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of animals have you seen so far?
An eagle.
You saw a bald eagle? Wow, is it big?
I saw some pandas and a zebra right behind me. I've been here for an hour or so, and I had a really good time here. It feels good not being in school.
So many kids, they're so cute.
They were, and the last girl, Chloe, her mom actually told me that she was a child that celebrated Easter Monday, so she's passing down that tradition with her daughter.
A lot of families here today as well, holding those conservation signs, celebrating conservation as well. Thank you so much on this Earth Day for watching us here in the briefing room on ABC News Live. Hope you download the ABC News app to follow the latest on climate change and all the political stories we've talked about today. Great to have Erica King with us.
Thank
Mary Alice Parks. I'm Devin Dwyer in Washington. We'll see you tomorrow.